Shalom and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm your host, Shani Reichman. Here at Israel Policy Forum, we spend a lot of time talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a conflict that is seemingly intractable at times and is also one of the better-known conflicts in the world today. I'm excited to be joined by someone who has worked to identify some of the key issues relating to conflict resolution, and hopefully we can explore together how those ideas can be useful in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. My guest today is Dr. Eran Halperin. Professor Halperin is a former dean of the School of Psychology at IDC Herzliya, and now professor in the psychology department at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's an award-winning researcher of emotional processes and field experimentalist. Dr. Halperin's research uses psychological and political theories to investigate causal factors driving intergroup conflicts. His work develops new approaches for modifying the psychological roots of intolerance, exclusion, and intergroup violence. The unique case of Israeli society in general, and that of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular, motivates much of his work, and most of his studies are conducted in that natural laboratory. Welcome, Eran.
Hi, Shani. I'm really happy to be here.
I think that we should start off with one of the bigger questions, which I'm sure you have many answers to. Why is it so hard to resolve conflicts? Not just this conflict, but ethnic, religious, and national conflicts in general seem really painful and wieldy to address. So are you able to pinpoint some of the specific trends that play into that?
Huh. You start with the easy questions, huh? That's the... I'll say, of course, you know, I will say right up front that, you know, I'm coming from a very specific, like, discipline and very specific approach. So my answer is not, you know, a comprehensive answer to your question, but it will be the answer that I'm usually, or I would give as a social psychologist or a political psychologist. And I think that the answer to your question from my perspective would be that the reason why it's so hard for societies to resolve long-term violent conflict is not the disagreements themselves. It's not the, you know, the ideological conflict between different societies. It's not the very concrete questions about, you know, where the borders should be, how do you address, I mean, these are not the real issues that prevent us from resolving conflicts. I think that what we believe as social and political psychologists is that, you know, these are the reasons why the conflicts began. But then throughout the years, for reasons that, you know, we can talk about if you want, societies develop some kind of a shield, okay, to protect themselves. And this shield, I would call it, you know, a psychological shield. And this psychological shield at the end of the road prevent them from identifying opportunities that could have potentially helped them to promote conflict resolution. So in many ways, what I'm saying is that it's not the real issues that prevent societies from resolving conflicts, but the psychological barriers, barriers like their collective memory, their societal beliefs, the belief that, you know, they are the moral side, the ultimate victim, the other side doesn't really want peace, their emotions, like their fears, their hatred, their anger towards the other side, and all these, what we call, you know, psychological infrastructure, basically prevent us from even entertaining the real opportunities for peace. So these are, I mean, these things that usually serve us, you know, so well in the dynamic of the conflict, because they help us to protect ourselves, are also the things that prevent us from, like, moving forward.
How do you overcome some of that? I mean, are there examples of other conflicts that have successfully overcome those emotional and psychological barriers? And if so, you know, how would that play in the Israeli-Palestinian context?
So I think that the first very, very important step is to even acknowledge that this is the problem. To acknowledge the fact that it's not, I mean, what we usually try to do, you know, think about every round of attempts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Most rounds look more or less like the previous round who failed, right? And in most rounds of attempts to resolve the conflict, we see another attempt in which both sides offer, you know, very concrete solutions. Let's put the border here, or let's, you know, move it, you know, 2 kilometers to the other side, or do something like that. And I think that the first important thing to do is to acknowledge that this is not really the issue. the issue, or at least, you know, before we approach the more concrete questions, we need to acknowledge the fact that these psychological barriers simply prevent us from looking at different solutions. And these things were done, you know, if you look at the Northern Ireland conflict. So you can see many what we call bottom-up processes that addressed people's, you know, levels of trust, levels of fear, the way they were able to suddenly take the perspective of the other side. And this is almost, you can think about it as a precondition that then helped them to actually, you know, deal with the real issues. Now, I can say that, you know, in the Israeli-Palestinian case, this is what, you know, we and others are, you know, been trying to do in the recent years. I mean, understand that before we even talk about the real ideological disagreements, let's think about, you know, why is it so hard for Israelis and Palestinians to even imagine that something can be different here, to be hopeful about the fact that maybe we can change the situation. And only then we can move forward to try and change these things.
I know that in your laboratory, you've conducted a bunch of experiments within Israeli society on how to generate hope and how to garner public support for peace and how to define peace in different contexts. Can you speak about some of the interesting findings of those programs?
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, researchers always love to talk about about their research. You'll have to stop me at some point. But I will say that what we're trying to do is to explore, I would say, unconventional ways to promote or to mobilize people to support peace. And what we do is, again, instead of directly talking about the real issues, we try to identify these psychological barriers that prevent them from even talking about these real issues seriously. And then we try to offer psychological interventions that would help them to overcome these things. So I'll give you two or three very quick examples. One example, you know, in line with what I said before about hope, we asked ourselves, why do Israelis and Palestinians refuse to even listen to the offers coming from the other side? And we did some studies basically trying to identify this barrier. And we realized that one of the main things that prevent them, both Israelis and Palestinians, from entertaining the ideas coming from the other side is that people are saying basically, you know, it doesn't matter what Palestinians are saying. They've always wanted to destroy us and they always will want to destroy. They will never, never change. You know, the Palestinians will stay the same Palestinians. And by the way, the Palestinians are saying the same thing about Israelis. They're saying they will never change. So if they have new offers or new ideas, they're probably trying to trick us or to do something. I mean, it's not really authentic in any way. So we developed an intervention based on the work of Carol Dweck from Stanford University, in which we made people believe in this simple idea that, you know, groups can change. When you think about groups throughout the history, groups went through some very, very meaningful changes in their values, in their motivations, in their behavior. And what we found, and this was a study that was published about 10 years ago, is that when you convince Israelis and Palestinians that groups can change, even without mentioning the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Israelis, Palestinians, nothing related to ideological issues, we can increase in about 30% the willingness of people on both sides to make the most dramatic compromises that you can imagine. And this is without even discussing with them, you know, the political issues or the ideological issues. Why was it so successful? It was so successful because it focused on a very, very specific barrier. This is the barrier saying, you know, that people say they will never change. And if you truly believe that the other side will never change, it really doesn't make any sense, you know, to negotiate with them, to offer gestures, to do anything that is possible. So that's one example. I can give you many more. Depends on, you know, how much time that we have.
Is it true, though? Are groups able and willing to change if the circumstances are right? Is there evidence of that? Have you seen it happen?
So I'll say, you know, I have two versions of the answer. answer to this question. One version would be that, in fact, it's probably true that some aspects of, you know, the group nature is stable and innate, whereas other aspects are, you know, developing and growing and changing throughout the years. So it's probably true that at least some aspects of the nature of groups can change. But the other version of the answer to your question would be that it doesn't really matter. Because I'm not dealing with the question of whether groups can really change or not. Instead of that, I'm asking myself, what can really mobilize people to support peace? And if I or we in the lab, using, you know, scientific tools, identify or reveal the fact that by making people believe that some aspects of group characteristics can actually go through meaningful change, if that can increase support in compromises for peace in about 30%, I think that it's quite a dramatic finding that also can be used in real life.
How does this whole dynamic manifest in different age groups? Because there's a lot of talk about the younger generation of Israelis who were growing up during the Second Intifada and who've never witnessed anything even close to a reasonable or successful peace process, right? And we know that they tend to be much more extreme. But are they extreme because they're young and they'll grow out of it? Or are we looking at a very like long-term change in Israeli public opinion? And I'm also curious on top of that to know if you think these normalization agreements with the Arab world will help in any way, because now some of their claims about how every single Arab country hates them has been proven untrue in a very positive way.
Okay, so I'll start with the first part of the question, and then hopefully I'll get to the second one. If I don't remember, please remind me. So to the first part of the question, I don't think that, you know, the younger generation of Israelis and Palestinians is more radical than their, you know, parents or grandparents. I don't think that's the case. I do think, and we have data and evidence to support it, that they have less hope. They have less hope, and I must say that it only means that they are very realistic. I mean, they see the reality as it is. And I will say, you know, I think that it is worth saying something about hope and about the nature of hope that can maybe explain or give answer to your question. One of the main things about, you know, that can make people hopeful about anything in life is their understanding that the situation is dynamic. You know, the things can actually change. Even if I have very, very bad day today, the fact that I remember that 3 days ago I had a very good or positive day means that I can imagine a situation in which 3 days from now my situation would be much better, okay? So the belief about the dynamism of the situation is really, really, really important in order to preserve or to promote hope. Now think about the young generation of Israelis and Palestinians. For them, when it comes to the, you know, the analysis of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for them the situation is static. And it has been static for many, many, many years. Now, if I think about myself, you know, I've experienced some, you know, peace negotiations, some of them fail, some of them succeeded. I've experienced some, you know, rounds of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, but also some handshakes on you know, in the White House and everything. My students, they've never experienced a positive event in their lifetime. And this is really, really dramatic. So for them, imagining a positive future is simply doesn't make sense because they don't have any anchor, you know, to rely on in this, in trying to imagine such positive future. So I don't think that they're more radical than us or than their parents. I think that they simply see the situation as more static. Now, to the second part of your question, I definitely think, you know, I have many, many negative or critical things to say about these seemingly peace agreements that are happening in the Middle East recently. And I think that they have some very problematic consequences, definitely for issues related to the specifically to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But at the same time, we also have to acknowledge the fact that they do provide some positive, at least potential, in terms of public opinion within the Israeli society. You know, one of the main barriers for peace is the fact that people see the out-group as totally homogeneous, like they are all the same. You know, all Jews are the same, all Arabs are the same, all white people are the same, all black people are the same. When you suddenly do peace, at least with some Muslim or Arab countries, people in Israel can no longer say all Arabs are the same. You know, suddenly there are, you know, the more moderate Arabs and the more extreme Arabs, the Arabs who want to make peace with us and the Arabs who, you know, who don't want to make peace with us. So suddenly the picture is much more nuanced and much more complicated. And on the top of that, you know, think about what I said before. Suddenly, things look much more dynamic. You know, peace is possible. No one imagined that we would have peace with any Arab country in this, you know, in this era. Suddenly, out of nowhere, I mean, in terms of the perspective of most of the Israeli public, suddenly it came. So it maybe it can also happen in other areas or in other aspects of our relations with the Arab world. And I think that there are some promising aspects, at least psychologically, in terms of public opinion in Israel.
One of the other factors that we know impacts public opinion in general is religion, right? And we see that there are obviously every year a larger portion of Israeli society is religious. And so I'm wondering how these religious convictions impact whether people are more or less willing to partake in conflict resolution exercises, especially when we're talking about a somewhat religiously rooted conflict, right, where religious texts are sort of contradictory, right? They can be read multiple ways. You can read them and read attachment to the land and an unwillingness to compromise on the land and a desire to remove other people living in the land, or you can also read it and learn about human rights and empathy and loving your neighbor, right? So there are multiple ways to read these religious texts, but how do you witness these religious convictions play out in Israeli society and in Palestinian society in terms of, you know, how willing they are to make peace and have hope?
I think that it's a great question. And I would say that at least my perspective on this is a little bit more optimistic, I would say, compared to most, you know, the analysis of most people that I'm usually hearing, at least about this case. I would say that, at least from what we see from our data, most objection among Israelis, among, let's call them, you know, center and right-wing Israelis to potential resolution or offers for, you know, a conflict resolution between Israelis and Palestinians are not based on neither, you know, ideological like arguments nor on religious arguments. So it is true that more and more people in Israel, and we refer mainly to the Jewish Israeli society, become more like some of them traditional and some of them more religious. But I don't think that it would be true to say that the main argument against conflict resolution or peace process with the Palestinians become more and more religious. I don't think that that's the case. Most people in Israel, among mainly I'm referring to the Jewish society in Israel, most objection or opposition to the peace process is based on more pragmatic arguments. So it's more about issues like, you know, there's no partner on the other side. There's no one to talk to. It's too risky to make peace because the situation in the Middle East is so shaky and unstable. So it's too risky to make peace. It's not. I don't see any, you know, a dominancy or centrality of the religious arguments in the public discourse on these issues. And it's interesting. I think that one thing that happened in this is more like, you know, in terms of the dynamics of the Israeli political system is that religious parties, and mainly ultra-Orthodox parties, who traditionally used to go either with left-wing coalitions or with right-wing coalitions, are now exclusively affiliating themselves with the right wing. And this is very, very problematic from, you know, from the perspective of people who are trying to promote peace in the Middle East, but it's more like a political issue and not so much, it's not really the religious argument that lead them to the to religious argument about the Israeli-Palestinian case that lead them to affiliate with the right. Even here, I think that these are more like political pragmatic considerations.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. And I think, you know, mildly optimistic, right?
You know, keep in mind that, you know, the spiritual head of Shas, for example, which is one of the two most important ultra-Orthodox parties in Israel, the Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, said very, very, very clearly that, you know, human life comes before the land, and we should make compromises on the land if we can ensure that it will save the life of many Israelis. So, you know, the religious arguments can go, you know, to many, many different directions. I think that what we have right now in Israel is more an issue of, you know, the right-wing politicians doing a much better work than the left-wing politicians in bringing ultra-Orthodox and religious parties closer to them.
You know, the last time we spoke, you had joined IPF Atid, our Young Professionals Program, in New York for a discussion that feels like it was a decade ago, but it was actually March 2019.
When people could actually fly, huh?
It's probably your last trip to New York. And it was before the first of four Israeli elections. And you spoke about how Israeli politicians play on different emotions to garner support for their ideas, how they manipulate the discourse. And you also explained why you believe that the left-wing strategy of incorporating right-wing ideas into their platform that are barely distinguishable from the Likud's views were destined to fail. And it seems you were largely proven correct. I'm wondering if you can speak more about how that played out over the last three elections and how can they reshape their strategy to maybe actually win a couple seats?
Wow, another simple question. I'll say that, you know, I think that what's happening today in this, is it the fourth? Yes, it's the fourth election in Israel in a year and a half or something, from the perspective of the left wing, is actually something that I believe that for the long term would be very, very positive. Whereas I think that on the short term, the left wing is gonna pay a price on actually doing it. And it's mainly or basically going totally, you know, the opposite direction from what I described in the previous election campaign. So I think that what the left wing in Israel is now doing for the first time for many, many years, and when I talk about the left wing, I mean from Yair Lapid, who will define himself as center towards the left, is to be much more clear about, you know, what does it mean to have a left wing ideology in Israel. So for the first time, all leaders of the left are talking about, you know, very openly about the need to create political partnership between Jews and Arabs in Israel, and about the fact that Arab parties should be part of the coalition of the left wing. This is the first time ever that center parties like Yesh Atid, like the Lapid's party, definitely the Labour Party, are putting this on the table. And this is quite a dramatic situation or move, I would say. They talk very openly about, you know, the need to renew the negotiations with the Palestinians under the, you know, the Biden administration, and to talk about the two-state solution. They don't try to hide anymore as, you know, to be like somewhere in between the left and the right and to hide their ideologies. Now, I think that what it means, as I said before, is that I don't think that the center-left can actually win the coming elections. I don't see any situation in which it will actually happen. But I do think that this will enable the center-left parties in Israel, Jews and Arabs, to start creating both the psychological and the political infrastructure that is needed in order to create change in the long term. And I see it as a very, very positive sign. I will say that, you know, living in Israel today, seeing that, you know, when you look at the public opinion polls, you see that almost two-thirds of the next Knesset parliament, Israeli parliament, is going to be based on right-wing and ultra-Orthodox Knesset members. This is quite, for me, it's quite depressing, but I do think that on the long term, there are some positive signs here. Positive signs that can actually give us hope. Give us hope that at least there are parties and leaders today in the Israeli arena that talk about a different future. Different future for, you know, the different ethnic groups within the Israeli society, and different future when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And this is something that we haven't seen in previous election campaigns.
So I'll give you reason to be a little bit less pessimistic about the incoming Knesset, because in some ways the Israeli public has shifted rightward, which you noted in the fact that they are voting for traditionally more right-wing parties. But in other ways, it's more left-wing than ever, right? There's the Likud party has members that technically support a two-state solution, right? You have a plurality of Israelis who prefer the two-state solution to any other options. And that is a phrase that people did not use, right? Even the left people didn't even say two states. They wouldn't even say a Palestinian state. They wouldn't acknowledge the concept of Palestinians being a people who deserve a state. So in some ways, we've actually moved much more to the center. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that you very nicely analyzed the situation. I don't need to say much more than that, but I will say, I think that there are two things or two opposite trends that happened in the last like two or three decades that are quite dramatic. The first one is that, and I, you know, it sounds like paradoxical, but this is the reality in terms of people's, and I'm referring again mainly to the Jewish society in Israel, in terms of their specific positions or attitudes about the potential resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Israeli public moved dramatically to the left. Dramatically. So if you look at public opinion polls 25 years ago or 30 years ago, the people who supported the two-state solution were a small minority of the Israeli Jewish-Israeli public. When you ask people today in Israel, would you hypothetically support the two-state solution based on the 67th borders in return for, you know, a final peace agreement between Israelis and Palestinians, you get the support of almost 70% of Israelis. 70%. This is a huge, huge majority among Jewish Israelis who are basically expressing or presenting left-wing positions. At the same time, in terms of people's, let's call it, subjective ideological identification, the Israeli public moved dramatically to the right. If you ask people today, how do you define yourself on a scale, let's say, of 1 to 7, when 1 is radical left and 7 is radical right, okay? So I would say that about 50% would be on the right side of the spectrum, another 30 to 35% would locate themselves on the center, and about 15% of the Jews in Israel would say, I'm a leftist, okay? And if you ask yourself, what's the reason for that? I would say that the definition, the ideological subjective definition of people today in Israel is not based on their positions about, you know, the end goal or the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but rather it is based on the disagreements that they have about how do they evaluate the current situation. So being a right wing means to say there's no solution to this conflict. There's no chance. There's no partner on the other side. There's no one to talk to. And we need to somehow, you know, handle or manage this situation without any attempt to try and promote peace. Being a left wing means to say, you know, situation is difficult, it's challenging, but I do believe that there can be and there should be a different future for us and for the Palestinians, and there is hope, and we should do whatever we can to try and promote hope. So I think that these two different trends are also telling us what should be done. If you actually want to do something to change the political reality in Israel, the main struggle should be the struggle on changing people's views about, you know, the way they analyze the current situation. And that, you know, the most impressive, I would say, achievement of Netanyahu and the right wing is that they managed to create almost a consensus around the way they analyze the current situation between Israelis and Palestinians. And the left wing didn't even, you know, fought back. And what we need to do is not just to convince people, yeah, at the end of the day, or the, you know, in 100 years from now, the two-state solution would probably be the one or the most relevant solution for us. No, that's not the thing. The thing is to try and somehow challenge the main themes or appraisals of the current situation, to convince people that there are specific partners on the other side, that there are positive signs on the Palestinian sides that can actually help us to promote peace, that there are reasons to believe that it is possible. And I think these signs actually exist, but we need to highlight them.
So it's a lot about their comfort level with the status quo.
Yeah, you know, in many, many ways, you can say Israelis don't really have good reason to even, you know, consider or challenge the status quo. You know, most Israelis, you know, will tell you, and again, let's leave the current situation, the corona situation aside. They will say, you know, Israel is in a relatively good, you know, economic situation. Security here, when you look at historically, has never been so good as it is right now in Israel. We all understand that any negotiation, you know, our, you know, the situation of Israel definitely under the Trump administration was, you know, it was great internationally. Okay. So, and all Israelis understand that any, you know, progress towards negotiation with the Palestinians would create some, you know, very, very difficult internal, you know, conflicts and tensions between different groups within the Israeli society. Why should we even consider it? I mean, what would be the motivation of Israelis to think more seriously about ways to move forward for peace?
Now that we're thinking of right-wing identifying folks, but who hold some left-wing ideologies in theory, what was the discourse like during the disengagement from Gaza? How did a right-wing leader get the political and public support in order to legitimize that action? Like, was there some sort of campaign? Did he use some of the techniques that you're describing? Did Ariel Sharon specifically use those techniques in order to get people on board?
Yes. So, you know, one of the main things that Sharon did when he tried to mobilize support for his disengagement process or plan was to create this threat about the future. So he basically talked to one of the most important sentiments within the Israeli society, and this is the sentiment of, you know, the idea of the Jewish state, okay? And Ariel Sharon repeatedly talked about what he called, I think that this is a terrible term, but this is the term he used, the demographic threat, okay? So he basically told Israelis, you know, we need to do something if we want to make sure that in the future, Israel will remain a predominantly a Jewish state, okay? And this threat about what would happen in the future if we wouldn't do something quite dramatic right now was quite effective in changing the positions mainly of, you know, centrists or moderate rightists within the Israeli society. And I think that it's very nicely connected to your, you know, to my answer to your previous question, because this is an example of a motivating factor that can actually move people, you know, or lead them to unfreeze and consider their positions moving from the status quo. So we need something that would scare us, right? It will tell us, okay, you think that everything is absolutely, you know, nice and pleasant right now, but if you will not do something quite soon, then there's some threat or fear in the future that can maybe lead you to lose something that is really, really important for you. In this case, it was the Jewish character of the state of Israel.
Was there some sort of psychological phenomenon that transpired in the wake of the disengagement from Gaza that led to this 10 years of Netanyahu and his rise to power and this rightward trend towards those parties? Was there something that happened to the Israeli public emotionally?
I must say that, you know, I haven't studied it. So everything I'm saying right now is, you know, based on speculations and not on empirical data. I think that, you know, some people would talk about, you know, some kind of a collective trauma, okay? And I think that there are two themes that are quite dominant today within the Israeli society that started, you know, developing in these events of the disengagement from Gaza and are still heavily impacting public opinion in Israel today. So one thing is, you know, we gave them everything, and this is what we got in return, right? So we disengaged from Gaza. We gave them something that was really, really important for them. We evacuated people from you know, their homes. And look, and what we got back, we got missiles. We got, of course, you know, the Palestinians have, you know, a very, very different narrative about this situation. But at least in terms of Israeli public opinion, this was another proof, okay, for the fact that, you know, you don't do business with the Palestinians. Because here is an example. We tried, we gave them something that was really important, and they didn't give us anything in return. I will say, in parentheses, that you know, Israel did not negotiate the disengagement. It was a unilateral disengagement. It wasn't coordinated with the Palestinians at all. Israel didn't, Israel closed the borders of the Palestinians from all, so it's much more complicated than that. So that's one thing. And the second thing that many Israelis will tell you today is that, you know, it's not really, it's not even feasible to try and think about, you know, evacuating so many settlers from their homes. It simply cannot happen. And they rely, or they use the example of the collective trauma of the disengagement, in which, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 settlers were, you know, removed from their homes, to say, how can, you know, think about how traumatic these events were back then. How can you even consider removing 100,000 or 200,000 Israelis or settlers from their homes? It's simply impossible. And if this is impossible on the one hand, and we've already seen, you know, that the Palestinians are not a partner based on what happened in the negotiation, in the disengagement process, then these two themes really prevent many Israelis from even considering moving forward.
I just want to compliment you on explaining that it's based on your assumptions and not based on empirical data, because almost everyone who comments on these conflicts, or a lot of the people who comment on these conflicts, don't use any empirical data. So it's nice to speak to a scientist who needs to tell you in advance when they're not using it.
But I always feel, you know, I always feel committed to at least say when I'm, you know, when I'm talking based on data and when I'm talking based on my ideas that can be, you know, as good as anyone else's ideas.
Appreciate it. Why don't you share a little bit about national symbols, like flags, And I'll tell you from my own experiences that Israeli and Palestinian flags do elicit certain emotions in myself, and that's my own bias. And so I wonder, like, that must exist for other people across the board, right? Like, flags and songs and chants and symbols eliciting really strong emotions. And how do you see that come into play in this conflict?
Yes, so it's interesting because, you know, symbols and flags are, you know, probably the ultimate, you know, symbol, but you're definitely right that, you know, songs and there are many, many other, like, different symbols, and they're very emotional. So people feel, you know, very, very attached to them. But at the end of the day, these symbols are, you know, they are associated with specific values or with even specific positions about the conflict. So think about, you know, there are studies both in Israel and in the US who are priming, in which people are, you know, scientists have primed the Israeli or the American flag, okay? But they primed it in situations in which different parties were ruling the government, okay? And they showed that the flag means something completely different when, you know, when there's a right-wing government in Israel in the last 20 years, many people will say, you know, the Israeli flag represents not just Israel, it represents the government of Israel, okay? And this creates some very, very serious tensions. And I think that in many, many ways, again, if we go back to the discussion about right and left in the Israeli arena, so the question of, you know, who is more patriotic, who is more Zionist, and the fact that in many, many, many ways, you know, the right wing are calling themselves a Machane Leumi, right, the national camp. So the nation is in a way identified or affiliated with the right wing. So it means that being, you know, loyal to the nation, meaning being a right winger. So that's, I think that this is part of the complexities that symbols can create. Because then, for example, there's, you know, then you can ask a question that for me is a very, very important question. So what does it mean? What does it say about people who criticize the nation, right, or the government of Israel? Does it mean that they are not loyal? Does it mean that they are not patriotic? Or you can say, and there is a term in our research called, like, constructive patriotism, meaning to say, you know, people who really care about their country would criticize their country because they want to improve it. So you know, it took me to slightly different directions than what you asked, but I think that, you know, symbols are not just symbols. Symbols in each and every time represent something different for different people, and this is a, you know, mostly a psychological, like, process.
Comment on that in the American context. Someone was just noting to me that when they see American flags, an American was commenting to me, when they see American flags in front of someone's house, they assume they're a racist. Which is really a horrifying idea, right? So I don't see it in the Israeli context as much, but I know it's there. But in the American context, I already see that playing out. So it's not surprising to hear that it happens in Israel too.
No, but it should be said that it is, you know, one of the privileges that you have in the U.S. that we don't have in Israel is that you're changing regimes like every 4 or 8 years, right? Whereas we have a right-wing government, you know, for the last, like, almost 20 years with very short breaks in the middle. And it means that, you know, being supportive of your country, it means practically in Israel being supportive of right-wing policies. And this is very, very challenging. I mean, you know, in Israel, the most obvious action of, you know, that expresses loyalty to the country is going to the army, right? Joining the army, joining, like, combat units in the army. This is in Israel, like, that's like being a real Israeli, you go through the army. When the army is mostly dealing, you know, in the last, like, you know, 15 to 20 years with, you know, actions within the occupied territories, doing policing, you know, things related to the Palestinians. So this is basically implementing a right-wing policy. It does create a challenge to the question of what does it mean to be a left-wing patriot in Israel. By the way, I think that it would have been very similar. Let's assume that there would have been a left-wing government in Israel that would promote peace based on the two-state solution, et cetera, et cetera. What does it mean to be a right-wing patriot in this case? It would have been probably very challenging.
Since we're already comparing the Israeli and American context, I have a question for you about protests. I know you wrote about it recently, and in the U.S. we saw many protests last summer in the wake of George Floyd's murder. And we've also seen a lot of protests in Israel, right, around different issues, around social justice issues, about corruption, social inequality. So what is the effectiveness of these protests? Does it matter what kind of protest it is?
That's a great question. And we've actually studied this question in the last two or three years, in both in Israel and in the U.S. And actually in other contexts as well. I think, you know, one insight that I have about this question is that oftentimes, quite paradoxically, people who engage in collective action or in protest don't really ask themselves, what impact would it have? Or how can we make an impact? They want to go out, they want to be in the streets, they want to share their views and their anger about the situation. And the question of, you know, down the road, how would it actually create change? Is quite a different question. We had some studies asking, you know, what kind of protest would actually promote change? And when we say promote change, we ask ourselves, when we think about asymmetric relations between different groups, you know, Jews and Arabs in Israel, race relations within the US, what kind of protest would lead high power group members to be willing to support policies that would promote equality and reduce discrimination and violence against low power group members? And we compare, you know, we usually compare, or we usually talk about either violent or non-violent actions. And I think that one really interesting thing that we found was that there is also a more nuanced version, something that is between the violent and the non-violent formats that can really be effective. And this is what we call a non-normative, non-violent protest. So what we found in our studies is that non-violent actions, unfortunately, create very, very little change. Very little change. So, and they create very little change because they seem very friendly, very constructive, but to be very honest, they don't disturb anyone. So they don't really do this thing that you have to do in order to promote change. And this is to lead the people in power or the high power group members to say, you know, we need to do something because it's disturbing and we cannot keep on living in this situation. On the other side of the spectrum, the very violent type of actions mostly create defensiveness. And when we studied why it's not effective to use violent actions, what we found is that violent action is perceived as being not constructive. So the protesters are perceived as people who are not trying to change the situation or to improve the situation. They are perceived as people who are coming to destroy the system. Okay? In the middle, there's an option of what we call non-normative, but also non-violent protests. And these are protests in which, you know, people for example, would block the roads, okay? But they will not be violent against, you know, the police. So they will disturb the situation. They will create this sense that, you know, we will not allow you to keep on living your life as if nothing happened. You will be disturbed. But on the other hand, they are perceived as being constructive. We don't want to destroy anything. We just want to improve, to create a better society. And what we saw you know, throughout, you know, 7 studies in different countries, in different situations, is that these more complicated versions of protests actually create positive change and willingness to promote changes in policies as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, Eran. This was really wonderful. Thank you to all of our listeners as well. And please don't forget to join us for our weekly Tuesday video briefings. We also have a new resource out called the Masterclass, and you can find it at israelpolicyforum.org/masterclass. It has explanations for a lot of the different issues relating to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I think you will enjoy it.